Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on groundwater depletion when we come back. You know, a $10 pizza has a 38% tax on it, and a Budweiser six-pack has a 43% tax, and a fifth of Jack Daniels is taxed at 72%. Now, governments tax us all, and they tax anything that wiggles, moves, or squirms. But what is it that government does to produce, to prepare, or to deliver, for which it gets paid 38% for a pizza, 43% for a beer, or 72% for a drink? Does the pizza parlor make a 38% profit on that pizza that they buy the ingredients to make, prepare it, cook it, serve it, and then pay rent on the store that you sit in to eat it? Why is it that government gets paid more in tax than the people who actually produce, prepare, and deliver the goods and services that we all buy? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, our school on tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and then send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Before we get into the groundwater story, there was a couple of articles that came across my desk, and I thought I'd share them with you. They're not something that we're going to spend a lot of time on, but you've heard me mention from time to time that foodstuffs here in the United States have lost their nutritional value. For instance, I mentioned to you that in 1880, the protein content of wheat coming out of Kansas was 24%. Some years back, I called for a load of wheat, and the guy asked me, the broker asked me, he said, "What protein content do you want?" So I shot back 24%. And he said, "There is no 24% wheat. It runs 7 to 13%. 7 to 13% is what wheat runs now in the marketplace. Now, in 1950, the protein content of wheat was 18%. 18%. It had dropped 6 whole percentage points, 25%, between 1880 and 1950. From 1950 through the 1980s, it dropped again from 18% to 13%. Now it runs as low as 7. I had a hog farmer down here one time, and he mentioned to me that he had a problem with his pigs and protein. He was buying a ConAgra ration, and his pigs were fat, healthy looking. They just looked great, and every once in a while, one would fall over, kick a little bit, and die. And they thought they had some wild, new, exotic disease in there, so they called the extension service, and of course they called the veterinarians out, and the state got involved in it, and everybody got to analyzing these pigs and doing autopsies on them, and they found that the pigs were suffering from a protein deficiency. So now you know that pigs, when the protein content of the feed that they eat gets too low, they just keel over and die. The protein content of the ConAgra ration was 7%. 7%. The pigs couldn't survive on it. So now that tells you a little piece of the story. Well, fruits and vegetables are not as nutritious as they were 50 years ago, and in spite of what Mother taught you about the benefits of eating your broccoli, data collected by the U.S. government show that the nutritional content of America's vegetables and fruits has declined during the past 50 years. In some cases, it has declined very dramatically. Donald Davis, a biochemist at the University of Texas, said that of 13 major nutrients in fruits and vegetables, tracked by the Agriculture Department from 1950 to 1999, six showed noticeable declines: protein, calcium, phosphorus, iron, riboflavin, and vitamin C. The declines ranged from 6% for protein, 15% for iron, 20% for vitamin C, and 38% for riboflavin. Now, it's an amazing thing, Davis said, adding that the decline in nutrient content has not been widely noticed or published. And he said, an agriculture scientist appears to have been the first to pick up the disappearance of nutrients in 1981 in a paper comparing the data on nutrients on garden crops grown in the United States with those grown in England. Davis, who discussed his findings at a recent meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting in St. Louis, Missouri, suspects the trend in agriculture toward encouraging crops that grow the fastest and the biggest is the reason for the decline. The past five decades have been marked by the Green Revolution, which has seen a marked increase in the production and yields as farmers have turned to the fastest growing and the fastest producing plants. This trade-off is that the faster growing plants are not able to acquire the nutrients that their slower growing cousins can, and either by synthesis or from the soil. And he said there are also differences in the amounts of nutrients lost in differing varieties of wheat and broccoli. Davis said that he doesn't want his study to encourage people to stop eating vegetables on the grounds that they lack nutrients. That's completely wrong, he said, contending that his study shows that people need to eat more vegetables and fruits, not less. Vegetables are extraordinarily rich in nutrients and beneficial phytochemicals. They're still there, and vegetables and fruits are our best sources for these nutrients. Al Brushway, a food science professor at the University of Maine and an expert with the Institute of Food Technologists, said that the decline of nutrients in vegetables and fruits could be made up through other foods that Americans eat. For vegans only using plant sources for food, this could be an issue, he said. But he said most Americans would pick up an adequate quantity of calcium that they need by drinking milk. Bushway said that fruits and vegetables are still crucial to providing nutrients that people need. They are an important part of the diet, an extremely important part, he said. Now, the Agriculture Department data that Davis used doesn't include all of the nutrients that scientists today can identify. I thought I'd share that with you because we've been talking about this thing of agriculture and agricultural groundwater. So let me connect these dots for you. A fellow by the name of Adolf Steinbrum, some years back, made a study on what is known as open pollinated seeds. Seeds that grow a lot slower. Seeds that when you plant them take longer to mature. Some years back, I happened to be out in New Mexico and up in a little mountain town called Taos, New Mexico. I ran across an Indian. And the Indian had some blue corn. And the blue corn dated back to 1939. And the thing that caught my attention was that 1939 was the year that I was born. So here was a big pot that he had of blue corn, Indian blue corn, that he had gotten from his grandmother. And I thought, now that's a novel type of corn, Indian blue corn. And I asked him for some of it, and he said, well, he'd be more than happy to give it to me. And so I took some of it, and I brought it home. Now, remember, I wasn't quite 50 at the time. I forgot exactly how old I was. So it was back in the 1980s, you know, 85, 6, 7, 8, along in there somewhere. And I brought it home, and I planted the corn, and did very well here. Didn't have any problem with it at all. It's small, and it's short. It is nowhere near the weight of productiveness that you get out of corn, say, grown in Iowa or Nebraska or South Dakota, you know, where they use hybridized seed and so on. The thing that I noticed was, as we tested the germination rate, you know, germination, when you buy a package of seed, it'll say the germination rate is 90%. The USDA requires that it be 90% or more. And that's why fresh seed is always better, because you get higher germination rates. So what that says is that if you plant 100 seeds, 90 of them will grow, 10 of them will be dead. Well, the germination rate on this blue corn now that was 50 years old, or right at 50, was 64%. Can you believe that? That's open pollinated corn. Now, they tell us that out of the pyramids, I've read a number of articles, that they have produced wheat and other grains out of the pyramids that have germinated. I never have seen a germination rate, but I've seen seeds germinated, taken out of the pyramids that were 3,000 years old. Now, try that with hybrid seed and see how long it lasts. We've got some seed here, various garden vegetable seeds that will not last more than 3 or 4 years. 3 or 4 years, and it's all dead, and it won't grow anymore. So you have to plant it year after year. Now, compare that to open pollinated seed. Now, let's take a look at the nutrient content. The nutrient content of the blue corn, when we had it tested, was 16%. 16% for the corn, compared to the average protein content of corn in the United States, which runs around 8 or 9%. Now, our soil here is pretty good, at least where we grow it, because I have worked for many years to build up the soil in our garden area. Now, listen to Adolf Steinbrunn's experience. During World War II, you know, our parents and grandparents planted victory gardens, and that helped to provide their food and fiber for themselves and for our country. But today, more than half of the food that we eat is imported from outside of our borders. Now, that's an important number. More than half of the food that we eat is brought in from outside our borders. Now, that doesn't mean that America doesn't export a lot of grain. It means that our tomatoes come from Mexico, down around Hermosillo. Our berries come from Guatemala. Grapes come from Chile. We import food into the United States. The common foods that you eat off your table every day, that broccoli and Brussels sprouts and so on, which back in the 1950s, 57% of all the table vegetables in America came from the Central Valley of California. Today, half of our food, common foods, come from overseas. Well, Adolf Steinbrunn of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter in perspective by having samples of corn tested for nutrients that are usually added to commercial feeds, compared to more than 4,000 samples of hybrid corn tested in 10 Midwest states in a recent year. Steinbrunn's open-pollinated corn contained 75% more crude protein, 875% more copper, 345% more iron, and 205% more manganese, and the same result has been seen in the content of calcium, sodium, manganese, and zinc. So in the opinion of many ecologic farmers, hybrid seed merely masks poor farming practices by producing bins and bushels of foodless food without the nutrients that are really food's reason for being. Now, how has this state of affairs developed? And the answer is through irrigation. When I was a youngster, irrigation was a novelty in the Eel River Valley. Back in the 1940s and 50s, nobody irrigated. Now, in the early days, when the settlers came into the Eel River Valley, the valley was covered by forests and trees. They cut the trees down, used them for logs and lumber. And then, now that there was nothing but stumps there, they cleared the stumps out of this flat land, and they began to raise grass. So they grow grass and clover and keep dairy cows. It became a big hub for the dairy industry there in Humboldt County, California. And as the years wore on, they just grow wonderful grass. Nobody irrigated. You didn't need to. The soil fertility was terrific. The organic material that had built up in that soil under those redwood trees for hundreds of years was, probably a foot thick. That's about what it is out in the forest floor today under the virgin forest. So I would imagine it was a foot, maybe more. And everything went great. Well, starting about 1950, now remember they settled there in the 1850s, 1854, they came into Humboldt Bay. So between 1860, the beginning of the Civil War, and about 1950, in that 90-year period, they had worn out the land. They wore it out. And in the summertime, it doesn't rain there in June, July, and August, and the grass would dry up. And so somebody got to thinking, well, maybe we should irrigate. So they started irrigating in the 1950s. And today everybody irrigates. And in fact, today you have to irrigate in order to get a crop, in order to keep the grass growing, because the organic material in the ground has been so depleted now that it won't hold moisture. Now, if you want to test this, there's a very common sense methodology for doing this. Take a garden hose and go out and squirt the garden hose on your concrete driveway, which has zero organic material. And, you know, just run the hose on it for about 5 minutes, and then come back an hour later and see how much moisture has been retained by the concrete. All right, now, take a bale of hay in your backyard and stick a hose into the bale of hay, turn on the water, let it run for 5 minutes, and then turn it off, and then come back an hour later and open the bale of hay and see how much moisture has been retained by that 100% organic bale of hay. If you want to test this a little further, you dig a trench across where you want to grow something, and then you drop bales of hay down into the trench. Don't open them, just drop the bales of hay in it. Cover it over with about 6 or 8 inches of soil, and then plant anything you want on top of that. And for the next 8 or 10 years, you'll never have to irrigate that again. And that's because the rainwater, when it rains down, percolates into the soil, and that hay in that trench that you put in there this year will last for about 10 years. In fact, it'll probably last longer than that, but the roots that go down into that straw will be growing down there to draw the moisture out. So you'll have plenty of moisture. And then at the same time, as that hay deteriorates, as it decomposes in the soil, and the worms get in it and use it and so on, the plants will be sucking the nutrients out of that, and you'll have more nutrients in your vegetables and plants. Now, that's normal, natural, organic material. That's a quick fix for putting in a garden in a confined area, a small area. It doesn't work, of course, on 5,000 acres, but it works very handily by bringing in somebody else's organic material and putting it in your backyard. I've got a garden spot out here with 6 beds, 2,400 square feet, that I can grow enough food to feed 6 people for a year. 6 people for a year on 2,400 square feet. It's what we call French intensive culture. And you don't need to irrigate it. There's plenty of moisture. Even if you're in Arizona, where you get 10 or 12 inches of rain a year. Now, just before crops come on, you may want to irrigate a little to make sure that there's plenty of moisture for the fruit to absorb to fruit out. But as a general rule, that'll solve your irrigation problem. Now, back in the 1950s, when we had worn out the soil or where there was drought, we decided we'd poke holes in the ground, which is the subject matter that we're talking about, and it's called irrigation. Well, from the 1950s until 2006, we have dug literally millions of these holes, drilled millions of holes all over the world, and we now are producing about 40% of our food crops out of irrigated water from aquifers that were drawing down faster than are naturally being recharged. And as we've already seen, some of these aquifers are not rechargeable. It's what we call juvenile water in volcanoes, or it's what we call ancient water, which has been buried at some point in the past, probably Noah's flood. And they're not recharged by surface water, as we saw there in Libya. Now, they've got 35,000 cubic kilometers of water in Libya. They can irrigate for a long time, but remember this, a long time is finite. At some point in time, they will pump it all out. Then what are you going to do? And the Achilles heel, as we've discovered this week, is this. In Arizona, when they started drilling and depending upon the groundwater to support populations, they built a big infrastructure called Phoenix in Tucson. Well, as long as you've got water, you can build big buildings and bring in massive populations of people. But the water's finite, and they're discovering that right now. They're in the midst of a 7-year drought. The groundwater is depleting, and the Colorado River is running at its lowest level in 500 years. Now, they're not going to be thrown out of Phoenix this year or next year or in the next 5 years. They tell us, the hydrologists tell us, that they can muddle their way through. They can use water rationing, and they've got a number of tricks up their sleeve to extend this for 10 more years. If the drought were to continue like it is for 10 more years, they can make it in Phoenix. That's what they tell us. But let's suppose that the drought continues and the population continues to increase in Phoenix. It's going to affect your property values because as the drought continues and water rationing is implemented, and I'm an outsider, you know, I'm a snowbird from the Rust Belt, and I'm thinking about, do I want to move to Phoenix or do I want to move to Miami? And I find that there is a shortage of water in Phoenix, and there's no shortage of water in Miami. I think that the property values in Miami will go up, and the property values in Phoenix will go down. Now, that's just my common sense. So tuck it away in your heart, because down in the Arizona area, there were Indians who were irrigating in Casa Grande, Arizona, for instance, and they were driven out about 500 years ago because of drought. And we saw a story here this week where in Yemen, their capital city, Sana, they've only got about 10 more years of water left. And that's what they tell us is left down there in Phoenix, about 10 more years. Kind of a similar parallel problem, isn't it? Now, this has never happened before, and so we're charting some unknown seas here. We have never had cities abandoned in our lifetime, at least that I know of, because of drought. But it has happened in the past. Bible prophecy says it's going to happen again in the future. What we don't know is with specificity, where is it going to happen? But the Ogla Ogla Aquifer is a prime candidate, and that covers 7 states here in the Midwestern United States. Now, the great magnitude of the problems that have been caused by the depletion of the world's groundwater resources is abundantly clear. And yet, except for China and India, there has been very little action by governments in Australia, for instance. The government has recently issued a report recommending the use of groundwater to supplement surface irrigation in the Murray-Darling Basin, a vast flat area that is the food bowl of Australia. The decision seems to have been made with no consideration whatsoever of the prospects of very serious damage of irrigation areas. Damage due to land subsidence caused by groundwater extraction or increased salt in the water table in the low areas, or earth fissures, such as in Arizona, and a firm conviction that recharge from the surface rainfall would maintain water levels forever. I believe that one reason for this inability of most governments to comprehend the situation lies in the nature of the professional advice that they receive. I note, as a professional, that in the scientific and professional journals of the world, there is never any mention of world groundwater problems. The professional groups most concerned with water resources and groundwater are all strangely silent about the worldwide decline of groundwater resources. The textbooks on groundwater hydrology appear to be part of the problem, not the solution. And they all show mathematical models of groundwater flow based on the key assumption that the groundwater is recharged from surface rainfall. As a consequence, the related computer models of groundwater flow are very seriously misleading. Now, these days, it is very easy for professionals to share ideas with colleagues all around the world, and one would expect that the serious matter of the worldwide decline of groundwater resources would command worldwide attention. But it does not. And it is apparent that the main cause of the silence is that the present understanding of the origin of groundwater by the professions involved is not at all consistent with what is actually happening. The theory is not working out in actual practice. And that spells global disaster, and the key experts are totally silent. Now, there is clearly a need for a new understanding of the origin of deep groundwater, and it is hoped that this book may be a step in that direction. Now, if you'd like a copy of the book, this article is adapted from the first chapter of the author's book, A Voyage of Discovery, a history of ideas about the Earth with a new understanding of the global resources of water and petroleum and the problems of climate change. Frankston, Victoria, Australia. The author is Lance Endersby. That's spelled E-N-D-E-R-S-B-E-E, published in 2005. The book is available from the Monash University Bookshop. This is called the Monash University Bookshop. I guess that's in Frankston, Victoria, Australia. And the author's name again is Lance Endersby, E-N-D-E-R-S-B-E-E. Now, I haven't read the book. I picked this up from, if you'd like to get a copy of this report, the EIR, which is called the Executive Intelligence Review, EIR, Executive Intelligence Review. You can go to their webpage. It's www.larouchepub.com. And that's spelled LAROUCHEPUB.com. Now, that's the main report that I wanted to give you, but now it's time to take a look at some collateral reports. A big report put out by the Kerr Center, it's called the Oglala Aquifer, published by the Kerr Center, gives us some greater documentation a little closer to home. Now, Lance Endersby has taken a worldwide view and given you a report in Chapter 1 of the declining groundwater. The reason it caught my attention is because of Revelation Chapter 6, which talks about the four horsemen of the apocalypse. One of those four horsemen that it deals with here is famine. This famine over here takes about one-fourth of the people on planet Earth. Let me run through the prophecy for you here before we take our break. The first one over here, called the first seal, when I saw the Lamb, this is chapter 6, verse 1, I saw the Lamb open one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder, one of the four beasts saying, "Come and see." And I saw, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow and a crown, was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. Then, second, we have war. Then when he had opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, "Come and see." And there went out another horse that was red, and power was given unto him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another, and there was given unto him a great sword. The third seal is opened, verse 5, and when I had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast come out and say, "And I behold, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, 'A measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny, and see that you hurt not the oil and the wine.'" And then finally the fourth seal, and when he had opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth beast come and say, "And I looked, and I beheld a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death, and Hell followed with him, and power was given unto him over the fourth part of the earth to kill with the sword, and with hunger, and with death, and with all the beasts of the earth." That's called the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. You've probably heard that famous citation before, you know, if you ever went to Sunday school, or Aunt Bessie, you know, was sitting there preaching you a sermon. And I noted that fourth part there, the fourth seal. Now, if you'll take a look here, war produces disruption and chaos. The disruption and chaos produces famine. Famine produces weak bodies. Weak bodies produce disease. And the conclusion of it is that one-fourth of mankind is wiped out by this event. So when I got into looking at this groundwater depletion over here, and remember, I'm an old-timey farmer, and I'm an old-timey irrigator. And in the Eel River Valley, and when I worked on the Eel River side of the river, that is the Lolita side of the river, we had a 30-foot well, 12 inches in diameter, with a 30-horsepower pump that would run 30 sprinklers. And the well was only 30 feet deep. 30 feet. As time has progressed along, the water table has dropped, even though there's this big river that runs right down through the middle of the valley. What they're really drawing from is the aquifer in the valley from the river water. And it probably will never go dry. I mean, they could go down 100, 200, 300 feet, and I think they'll always have water there because it's always recharged by the river. But the point is, the water table has declined, and it's declined because more people are irrigating out of the river, whereas in 1960, only a few were irrigating. A 30-foot well was adequate. Today, it's much deeper. Now, that's a rechargeable aquifer. They can get away with irrigation. But in many of these aquifers, such as the Oglala, the aquifer is over a large piece of ground. It is rechargeable, but it is being banked, or it is being withdrawn from the bank of water at a greater rate than the aquifer can recharge. So some common sense tells us that at some point in time, that one, the irrigation agriculture is going to collapse. Probably not over the whole region all at the same time, but 6% of it has already collapsed. And it is going dry at the rate of 6% a year. And in the next 20 years, it's going to be pumped out to a point where it's going to affect 40% of the agriculture in the United States. Now that, boys and girls, is scary. If it doesn't scare you, then you're beyond help. But if it's scary, then it says to you, you need to take some kind of evasive action. It says, uh-oh, I'm living in Phoenix, and the water is going to run out in 10 years. My house is worth $500,000 today. What is my house going to be worth 10 years from now if there's water rationing? How many new people will want to move into the Phoenix area with water rationing? What happens if there's not enough water for agriculture and the city? You can rest assured that the agricultural water will be taken first. So if you're a farmer down there in that region, you're going to lose all of your water. Then industry will come second. I mean, you know, people have to have drinking water. So the people in their houses with the drinking water. But boys and girls, while you're drinking water in your house because it's been rationed and the farmers have none and agriculture has collapsed in Arizona and industry is next, where are you going to go to work when there's no water for the job or the industry that you're working in? And you know, boys and girls, this is serious business. Let me give you a reminder here, and we'll take a look at the Kerr Report. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, 7 days a week worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, economics, history, health, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. The endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that these authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. I don't know much about this thing called the Kerr Report. We took it off of the web. I took it off the web because it was an in-depth study of the Ogla Aquifer, and it corroborates the EIR report. Now, it's not the only corroboration. I was so shocked at the numbers that I saw from this groundwater depletion over here that I ordered up four or five corroborating reports from four or five different sources. It isn't that the information isn't out there or that the science hasn't already been done. It's that it isn't being reported. And Bob Schieffer isn't very likely to give you the report on the CBS Evening News that groundwater around the world is drying up and it threatens the survival of humanity. Now, the Messiah made an observation in Matthew chapter 24 in which he cited some events that we should be looking for just prior to the second coming. His disciples came up to him in the early chapters, or the early verses of the chapter. This is Matthew chapter 24 now. And you can read this in three locations. If you got a pen, just write these down. Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. Those three are parallel chapters. And I came up to him and I said, "Hey, boss, tell us what's the story going to be looking like when you come back to planet Earth, when you return? The end of the world, it's called there, the end of the age." So he said, "Well, gather around, boys, and let me tell you the story." So the boys gathered around. And he said, "Here's what you should be looking for." And he described a disease, and he described war and famine. And so we're all familiar with the prophecy, war, famine, and war, via nuclear war. And he, as he's describing this over here, goes on to say that unless I come back and intervene, if I don't come back here and stop you people, no flesh would be saved alive on planet Earth. Well, boys and girls, that's a big order. That's a pretty tall order. It's never been possible to eradicate all life from off this planet until World War II, when we discovered or developed nuclear energy. By 1957, it wasn't possible, but by 1960, it was, and we were informed in 1960 that the United States of America, combined with Russia, and then with the new British and French experimenters, you know, getting into the act in the 1950s, that the world had enough nuclear capacity to annihilate, to eradicate, to kill everybody on planet Earth. And they talked about a nuclear winter. And we learned in school to get under our desks. You know, we were expecting the Russians to drop bombs on us any day. By 1970, the early 1970s, the number had risen dramatically to 43 times. 43. I mentioned this the other day. I thought once was more than enough. But the world combined, that's mainly the Russians and the Americans, had enough nuclear capacity to annihilate all life from off the planet 43 times over by the early 1970s. Now, today, as I speak, in the year 2006, the latest number that I saw, it's down to just 34 times. It's down by about nine times. But we still have enough. Don't fear, boys and girls, that we don't have enough nuclear weapons. There's now enough to annihilate all life from off the planet 34 times over. And under the SALT agreements, they say that they're going to reduce that capacity even more. My God, you know, if we keep after this, why we'll be practically bankrupt. We'll only have enough nuclear capacity to annihilate all life from off the planet three or four or five times over. That's why I mentioned the other day, I think that we're still searching for intelligent life on planet Earth. I don't think we need to be looking for intelligent life out in space. And I think that there's plenty of intelligent life out there in space, and they're called God and angels. I think where we're deficient in intelligent life is here on planet Earth. So we've got disease, water depletion, peak oil, nuclear war, and famine now that are five big problems that threaten the future existence of mankind on the planet. Not that peak oil is going to kill all of you people suddenly, but let me tell you that when we start running short of oil, it's going to trigger wars over the declining or the lesser reserves of oil, and those reserves are in the Middle East. And that's where Armageddon takes place, in Palestine, in Israel, 35 miles northwest of Jerusalem. I mean, there's a physical location for this place that we call Megiddo, where the book of Revelation describes an army of 200 million men fighting and the blood reaching to the horse's bridle. It really sounds impossible. Sounds kind of crazy. One day I was in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and while we were there, we were close to Gettysburg, my wife and I said, you know, we should probably go over to the Gettysburg battlefield and take a look. Well, this little town of Gettysburg's not very big. And there's a big national park there. I don't know how big it is, but it's as big as that battlefield is. So we went to all the tourist sites there at the Gettysburg battlefield, and there's a place called Little Round Top. And we saw where Pickett's Charge took place. Pickett's Charge, 15,000 men are killed on this battlefield. I mean, it's a sobering place to be. As you read the plaques, you know, that they have scattered around, you know, describing what happened here and then what happened there and where were the Union forces and where were the Confederate forces and so on. And so, as we went around, we got to the last place we went to. It was a place called Little Round Top over here, and 6,000 Confederate soldiers. Well, 6,000 is Confederates. I guess it's 6,000 men altogether. Died charging up this little hill. Wasn't very big. It's just, you know, a little rise. It's not impressive. It's not like charging, you know, up the Grand Teton Mountains there in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. It's just a little hill. And down at the bottom of this hill is this little creek, little brook, something like that. You know, you can jump across it. And the placard down there says that 6,000 men died on this hillside, and this little creek ran red with blood for 3 days. I didn't write that. I'm just reporting. That's what the placard said. And I thought about that, and I said, my God. This little creek ran red with blood for 3 days from 6,000 men dying on this hillside. So I just added it up a little bit. I said, let's see, we got 6,000 men here. I imagine some of them fell in the creek, and some of them are dying, you know, on both sides of the creek. And it might have been raining or something. And how much blood is in a human body? And somebody told me about a gallon and a half, about 6 quarts. Well, I said, well, let's suppose that you probably couldn't drain the whole body out. You know, you shoot somebody and it bleeds, and you bleed out. But, you know, I was assuming that a gallon, you know, would come out of each body. That'd be about, you know, 2/3 of it. So we get 2/3 of it out, and I said, well, there's 6,000 guys, and 6,000 guys is 6,000 gallons, and 6,000 gallons of blood leaking out on the ground and then washing down or washing into the little creek down there for 3 days. That's a tanker truck. You know those gasoline tanker trucks, you know, that pull up at your local 7-Eleven store and offload gasoline down there? They haul 6,000 gallons. 6,000 gallons. Now, picture 200 million men fighting a battle out here on the battlefield. Yeah, I could picture some place out there on the battlefield where enough blood could accumulate from the bodies of 10, 15, 20, 30, 50, 100,000 people, out of 200 million, that would be as deep as a horse's bridle, which is about 3 feet. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could figure that. Pretty sobering. Pretty sobering. And then as I watched the news, you know, on the Bob Schieffer CBS Evening News, and almost every night they talk about this thing of Iran. I think we're getting prepared for war with Iran. Pat Buchanan was on the McLaughlin Report. You know, the McLaughlin Group on PBS. And Pat Buchanan said there will be war in Iran by September. And I thought, well, now, this guy Buchanan ran for president a couple of times. Do you remember that? He was on President Nixon's staff He was a staff writer for President Nixon, Pat Buchanan. I don't know if he's an insider. I kind of suspect that he's pretty well positioned. He's a commentator. He's a writer. And he said, war in Iran by September. Now, you know, boys and girls, we're starting to get pretty serious here. You know, you go to war with Iran over there in the Middle East, and they have 10% of the world's oil. 10%. The Iraqis have 25% of the world's oil. Now, between the two of them, that's 35%. That's a third of all the oil that we know about on planet Earth. All of the reserves, one-third of them, are in those two countries. And, you know, we've been making some pretty heavy noises concerning Iran's nuclear capability. And the other day I saw a little piece I'll bring to your attention here. A little piece came out about the United Nations sanctions, and the Chinese and the Russians have both said that they're opposed to sanctions. And both of them have a veto, of course, in the Security Council. So you're not going to get sanctions against Iran. The Russians and the Chinese are going to veto it. Both Russia and China have nuclear weapons. Both Russia and China are the sworn enemies of the United States, NATO, and the West. And the world has reached peak oil. Now, on top of that, we find that the groundwater supplies around the world have been depleted to such a degree that over the next 20 years, you know, we're talking about 2006 through 2025 or 26, are going to run dry, many of them, including the Oglala Aquifer, if I'm pronouncing that right, Ogallala, O-G-A-L-L-A-L-A. It's an Indian word, a little tricky for us white boys to pronounce. Ogallala Aquifer, going dry over the next 20 years. 40% of our agriculture is dependent upon it. Not to mention the problems in India and China, who have one-third of the world's population. Now, you know, you start putting these stories together, and then you read Matthew chapter 24, it gets kind of hair-raising, doesn't it? And then Pat Buchanan says we're going to have war by September. I don't know if he's a prophet or not. I'm not. I can't tell you. But that's his prognostication. Now, you take a look at the economics around the world. We have every country in the world now in a fiat currency. The United States depends upon $2 billion a day coming in here from foreign investors. And our government and everybody around us tells us, God, our economy is strong and everything is just wonderful. As our Congress raises the federal debt limit ceiling to $9 trillion. We owe $149 trillion. We've got $200 trillion worth of derivatives floating around in the world. We've got economic instability everywhere in the world, and they tell us, don't worry about a thing, everything's fine. I don't know, this old country boy is getting a little nervous down here in the Ozarks. Well, let's get started on this thing, introduction. We know the value of water when the well runs dry. That's a famous old-timey statement by Benjamin Franklin. Now, the purpose of this section is to introduce the prevailing water requirements in the United States. And further, the section focuses on the declining as well as deteriorating water conditions in the Oglala Aquifer. This aquifer plays an important role in fulfilling the needs of the American people. I'm going to underline that. In fulfilling the needs of the American people. Not just the seven states where the aquifer is located, boys and girls, because it's located in South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, and one other state. I've kind of forgotten now. Seven states. That's what we call the breadbasket of America. The breadbasket of America, boys and girls. 40%. Is raised right there. That's what it's going to affect, 40% of American agriculture. The Oglala Aquifer, also known as the High Plains Aquifer, is now facing declining water levels, and deteriorating water quality. More than 90% of the water pumped from the Oglala irrigates at least one-fifth of all U.S. cropland. This water accounts for 30% of all groundwater used for irrigation in America. Crops that benefit from the aquifer are cotton, corn, alfalfa, soybeans, and wheat. These crops provide the Midwest cattle operations with enormous amounts of feed and account for 40% of the feedlot beef output here in the United States since the advancement of agricultural irrigation in the earlier part of the 20th century. The High Plains Aquifer has made it possible so that states such as Nebraska and Kansas can produce large quantities of grain required to feed the livestock. So you've got a symbiotic relationship here. You grow the grain for the cattle industry, and then those feedlots out there feed that grain. 40% of the beef produced in the country comes from there. 40% of the crops grown in America come from this region, the breadbasket of America. If the High Plains aquifer were unaffected by human activities, it would be in a state of equilibrium, in which natural discharge from the aquifer would be approximately equal to the natural recharge to the aquifer. However, activities such as pumpage from wells, surface water diversions for irrigation, and hydroelectric power generation and cultivation and grazing practices result in non-equilibrium in the aquifer. The result is that discharge does not equal recharge in many areas. This non-equilibrium results in substantial changes in groundwater levels. Half of the U.S. population, and almost all of those in rural areas, draw water from underground aquifers for their domestic needs. Now notice I'm going to underline that one. Half of the U.S. population relies upon this aquifer, which is being pumped dry. Now additionally, farmers depend upon the aquifer for irrigation. Now, once thought an unlimited source of pure water, these sources are increasingly threatened. And while toxic waste dumps, cesspools, landfills, and septic tanks contribute their share of wastes to groundwater, agricultural chemicals contribute the most in sheer volume and affect the greatest area. Excess nitrates from fertilizer and manure can leach into the groundwater, and in high enough concentrations, they can make such water dangerous to drink. Hang on. Get rid of that static. Other farm runoff can also reduce water quality. Furthermore, some farm pesticides pollute groundwater in agricultural areas. Now that's kind of serious business. We got pollution. We've got a declining water table. 40% of the beef, 40% of the grain grown in America, not just grain but cotton and other crops, come from this aquifer, come from this region. And conservation of water is therefore imperative. It's extremely important that we search for solutions to deal with the problem, and we also need to urgently explore the alternative approaches that should or could be taken instead of those being implemented now. Well, you can rest assured that nobody's going to make any changes because the economic consequences are too severe. Nobody wants to be the first guy to shut off his pump. I know. I'm one of them. I draw my water from the groundwater. I'm not going to do that forever. I'm going to make some meaningful changes here. But, you know, most people are locked in to the groundwater. Half the population of America is locked in to this groundwater. A solution has to be affected. A solution will be affected. But does it require some kind of a catastrophe to occur before? Or could we make some kind of provisions before the fact and alleviate part of the pain? We'll take that up next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. That's it. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.